This is In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle.
It's another Sunday afternoon, Marie.
Glad to be here, everybody. So glad you could join us. Conversations you care about. And Rochelle, we're running the gamut today.
Well, you know, this has been such a horrific week coming out of that shooting in San Bernardino. And, you know, we'll spend a little time on that. But the rest of it is all about renaissance and excitement and fudge.
And fudge and bumpy cake. We're going to get to bumpy cake a little bit later on in the show. And we'll also take a really great snapshot back on the city of Detroit, one little corner of the city. So stay with us here on In the Mix, conversation you care about.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle is sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health.
Up first, we all have fond memories of something called the Hudson Stores. If you're a native Detroiter, you know what I'm talking about, the entire shopping experience of going to Hudson's, especially downtown. Joining us, Joseph L. Hudson, Jr., trustee of the Hudson Weber Foundation, and last week awarded the Alan E. Schwartz Community Leadership Award from the Detroit Economic Club. Mr. Hudson, thank you for joining us on In the Mix.
Marie, it's my pleasure, particularly this holiday season.
Oh, absolutely. Tell me, now you are, what relationship to the founder of J.L. Hudson? He was your great uncle, right?
That's correct. My grandfather was a brother of J.L. Hudson, and my grandfather ran a Hudson's Men's and Boys store in Buffalo, New York. So I'm a great nephew of J.L. Hudson.
And the store was started in 1881, is that correct?
That's correct. That was a few years ahead of my time.
Mr. Hudson, tell me about your first impression of Detroit. When you first arrived here, what was your first impression of the city?
Well, I've told the story a number of times recently. Growing up in Buffalo, my family decided we should visit Detroit. I should learn about Detroit and also the Hudson store. We took the overnight steamship up from Buffalo. That no longer runs, but it was a fun trip for a teenage youngster. And we came up the Detroit River, and I called for my father. I said, Dad, look at this. There's a building over there, red brick with the name Hudson's on top of it. He said, Silly, that's one reason why you're coming to Detroit. That's the J.L. Hudson Company. That was my first impression of Detroit.
So you were not aware of your family's roots here in the Detroit area and really the reverence that so many people held for the Hudson's?
Well, it seems impossible. I obviously knew that there was a store, but and my father was in the retail business with a department store in Buffalo. So I was familiar with department stores and knew there was a wonderful store in Detroit, but I was quite amazed to see that there was a tower that ended up being 26 stories tall on top of a store. And that was my first impression. Of course, a few years later, I came out in the summertime and worked for several summers for 3 months, learning the business from the loading dock up to the executive floors. And the rest is history. It was a wonderful experience and a great institution.
You know, what's interesting about what you just said is that I think today a lot of family-owned businesses, I don't mean to make a blanket statement like that, but a lot of them that I hear of don't bring their kids into the business the way you were brought in. You had to go work in the loading dock during the summer, and you had to learn that business start to finish. How did that prepare you for running that company?
Well, it gave me a perspective that was quite unique. I think I should mention that when Mr. Hudson died in 1912, he was succeeded by four Weber brothers. They were his nephews, and they formed a team and developed the J.L. Hudson Company into the modern era. And so there hadn't been any Hudson in the store for 40 years, which gave me quite a break to appear to be just another person with that name, but not big part of the family.
I see.
And, I had great opportunities and worked in the warehouses and the sales floors and in the merchandising offices. So I had a chance to really have a good development in a short period of time.
A lot of people think that the Hudson family or the Hudson name sort of went out when the store closed downtown, but that could be farther from the truth. Of course, you've done a lot of work, of course, with the Hudson Weber Foundation. You've served as the president and chairman there and the first president and CEO of the Detroit Medical Center back in 1985. You've seen Detroit in the excellent days when you said you were a teenager all the way now through some pretty rough times. What are your thoughts here when you see this new resurgence of activity in the city of Detroit?
Well, it's been a long time coming, and it's taken a lot of hard work for thousands and thousands of Detroiters. But we went through the difficult period of the bankruptcy here a year ago, and still has not put us on a complete recovery, because while downtown is dynamic and midtown, it was hard to find a place to live despite all of the reconstruction of former buildings or the modern residential apartments. But there are neighborhoods throughout the city of Detroit that still have to experience some of the work. But that's underway. The mayor today is doing an excellent job working on what's called the street lighting program, cleaning up the neighborhoods, removing blight. That's still a work in progress. That's going to take some time. But we had some difficult years in terms of the history of Detroit has been boom town and then difficulties in economic downturns of the economy. We'll still have challenges in the future, but we're on the way, and it's exciting to have lived through this period and now see the future Detroit before us.
And I have to ask you very quickly about the state of retailing in general in this country today. Sir, I cannot tell you the number of people that I know, including myself, that say, well, do you remember when you'd shop at Hudson's? It wasn't like that. I mean, the Hudson's shopping experience was held with such reverence. I still have a Hudson's box that holds a handbag in my closet that I absolutely covet. Nothing's ever going to happen to that Hudson's box. I mean, when you hear stories like that, and I know that you do, what do you think? And what do you think of the state of retailing today?
Well, it's a quick answer is it's different.
I'd say.
hang on to that box and that memory, because there aren't department stores or that type of retailing. It doesn't exist in the United States typically. Maybe New York City, Bloomingdale's might be an example. But retailing has always been a revolution that started with the bazaar in Turkey and Istanbul hundreds of years ago. In the early 1900s, the late 1800s, the department stores were born in Paris and London and then in New York and the like. People wanted the full shopping experience.
Right, right.
You might have gotten on a streetcar to go downtown with your family. That's not typical today, and I don't think that's going to come back.
Well, some of us will hold out hope, Mr. Hudson. Sir, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it, and God bless and all the great work that you continue to do in the city of Detroit and beyond.
Nice talking with you.
Belt Magazine is an online place for dispatches from the Rust Belt, and one of those is from our own Tim Kiska, who has written a beautiful, beautiful elegy about his family life and history here in Detroit. And Tim, welcome to In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle.
Hi, thank you for the invite.
Thank you. I can tell you that this was really beautiful, and I was going through to find a passage that struck me so boldly and so hard. You were talking about Connor Avenue and that dividing
yep.
line between blacks and whites.
Yep.
And I just want to read a sentence from that. The Chrysler plant on Connor formed a natural barrier like a mountain between nations. Black kids seldom ventured across that line for fear of tangling with greasers, guys wearing leather jackets, slick back hair, and chips on their shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of a scene from Grease, except it would have been a drama.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about those times and what that was like, particularly just in that neighborhood and between, you know, these disparate factions that are, you know, getting along so much better now, at least here in Detroit, where people can ride their bicycles.
Yeah, well, your point's well taken. I mean, it's I think it is a lot better. But back then, I mean, it was, you did not cross over Connor. If you were, I tried that. Let's see. Once with my bike, and I got mugged.
Oh God!
The other time I got mugged standing on the street corner of Mac and Connor, waiting for a bus. But I think when I think about this stuff, it is so depressing because you had two groups of people that there was just basically no understanding, not a lot of dialogue, and what was really uncomfortable. I was in a band that practiced over at Jackson Junior High School, and it was white kids and black kids.
Oh wow!
And I just remember after the 67 riot civil disturbance, it's like nobody knew what to say to each other. You know, it was like, what's going on out there? So it was uncomfortable. It was scary. We were like knee deep and nobody understood anybody else. Nobody was talking. And I think that that's changed over the years, but it tells us something about how long this is, how far we've come.
Yeah, well, we're talking to you about your piece in Belt Magazine, One Block, Two Businesses, Three Families, A Detroit Story. One of the problems that we have here in Detroit, at least as long as I've been here, is that we don't tell our story. We let other people, you know, paint the narrative, decide what we are and who we are. I'll never forget learning after I got here that there was just like maybe one car burned after the 84 World Series, and that it wasn't kids who were burning down the city on Halloween. So what about that story, and what made you want to do this?
Well, I mean, I think you and Marie, who are both great reporters, would understand this basic curiosity. I happened to drive by my dad's old store. It was about the middle of last July, and it had burned. And I thought, I got to find out what the heck happened. I just had to know. So then as I got into it, I thought, wait a minute, why don't I tell this whole story about the entire history of Detroit? Not the entire history, but post $5 day, you know, just from the point of view of what was going on in that storefront. And it was more like, I just needed to know. And I think, you know, you're a reporter, you'll understand that it's one of these things where it's basic curiosity that was driving me on this thing.
And Tim, in this article, what I found so endearing about the article was the fact that you went through the storefront with the Edward F. Kiska Jewelers, occupied the small storefront in the 60s, one spot. But then there was the Chinese restaurant, and then there was you all lived above the stores.
Mm-hmm.
And you went into great detail about everyone who lived and had businesses in this one block. And that's mm-hmm. what was so lovely about the article. And you actually said that the people who owned the Chinese restaurant ultimately stayed there the longest, right?
Yes. Yeah, they moved in. The owners of the restaurant, George and Mary Louie, moved from, they were above the restaurant. They bought our old building and then moved into our old place. And this is a classic Detroit story where they hung on, they hung on, they hung on. The neighborhood became extremely dangerous. Over a period of time, mostly gang members, and the kids were telling them, look, you got to get out of here. It's not normal to hear gunfire at 2 in the morning in front of your place. But they wouldn't go, and then eventually they left because they both got way up in years and needed some help, so they ended up in a senior citizen's place out in Royal Oak. But it's a very common story, in the city. What you do about that, Murray and Rochelle, I don't know. You know, if somebody can figure this out, I think they seriously deserve a Nobel Prize.
I would agree with you. You know, because Marie and I are both reporters, we look at something like this and we see the amazing amount of work that it took. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like to go back and find some of that research? The things that you knew, but the other things, the numbers and some of the other stuff. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, a couple things. Here's what's kind of curious about this. I went into this thing, and I thought I knew stuff about my own family, and about a third of what I thought I knew was wrong or somehow mangled. That was kind of interesting to me. So, I mean, there were a lot of little things. Like, I remembered moving A, the riot started, but there were still a couple details that always confused me. When I went back and interviewed my mother, I said, you know, she said, no, it was day two, and then she laid out everything. So that was part of the research. The other part of the research is, I do a lot about this Chinese family who are great friends of mine who live next door. And I didn't know the backstory of their parents coming over from China Mrs. Louie, who helped run the restaurant. I mean, she, you know, I mean, I didn't know any of this. So I interviewed Ming Louie, who is the couple's oldest son, did a lot of that. I spent a lot of time interviewing sons and daughters of different people who lived up and down. I spent time at the Burton Historical Collection looking at the cross directories to sort of get boned up on what was on that block over the years. So I did a lot of the stuff like that, a lot of research on when some of these folks, there's a guy in that article, Art Senave, who came over from Belgium, you know, when he got there. And it, by the way, this is one of the things that was during the research that you know, this is a good example of things that you thought you knew. My dad always told me, or I just remember that he told me that Art Senave, who was the name of the Belgian immigrant who started the jewelry store, my dad eventually got, but it started in 25. I was told he was in the military in World War One. And I looked up his date of birth. He would have been anywhere between 14 and 18.
Wow.
During the war. And I thought, that's a little bit young to be in the Army. And I ended up calling his daughter, because I always took this as fact, you know, and I called up his daughter and she said, oh, your dad, was he in the military? No. He was too young. He took care of him. It was a Belgian doctor's took care of a Belgian doctor's horses. So there was a lot of that kind of thing. Yeah, I was you know, interviewing people, going back to the record, the written record, as often as I could, because I got to tell you, I mean, this drove home, you know, it's not what you know that'll kill you. It's what you think you know that's wrong that'll lay you out. That's what drove me.
Tim, I have to tell you, I thought it was a 5-star article for one reason in particular. You mentioned the people of Luxembourg in your article. Of course, that was my father's adopted homeland before he came to America. So I laughed when I saw that, because Luxembourg's about as big as Rhode Island. But you mentioned again about the immigrant story. I mean, you mentioned the Belgians, the Luxembourgers. Who else was mentioned there?
Manx.
Right.
Nobody knows what Manx. They think they're cats. No. They're people from the Isle of Man.
Right. But again, this rich, rich fabric that made up your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I love that you made it a personal story. Like Marie said, this was a place and time and in Detroit, but this was your life. And when you talk about why you had to do this, you wrote, I needed to see the end of the story. How many times have we pushed ourselves to do something because we just had to make sure we got to the end of the story? Or the reverse of that, I need to know how we got here.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit? I know with all of the stuff that happened on that street, you began with this immigrant couple from Belgium, continued with the large family from Centerline, Goat Kiskas, and then ended with a hardworking Chinese couple. What made you decide to use those particular folks? Was that necessary?
Well,
that's what it was?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was, okay, I wanted to do that store, just, you know, who lived above that storefront as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what, you know, when I started getting into it, by the way, which is something you mentioned, I think you could probably do the same kind of story about almost every block.
Right,
absolutely.
That's why I think this thing is ringing a bell, because I think a lot of people look at this and say, yeah, that's my story too. But I just decided I needed to restrict it to just regular people. And what really, I still kind of get choked up on this. I think about the hours my father worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day to keep that thing afloat. I think about that Chinese couple who spent 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just constantly there trying to keep that Chinese restaurant afloat. The Belgian guy who gets here, and worked for 40 years, you know, to run a business. I thought, what heroism. And I that's what sort of really got me. And I never stopped to think about this. Wow. I mean, these people, the hours that they worked, the effort that they put in, the superhuman effort that they put in just to make it go. And this is just one block in the city of Detroit. And I guess when I come back, I start thinking about this. I said, you know, when people start knocking the city and I'm thinking, no. You know, the point of this article is have a little respect, you know?
Good for you.
Right. Good for you.
So, I mean, that's what sort of got me into doing, you know, By the way, this is a classic journalistic technique. You tell a bigger story through the smaller story.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, we're glad you did, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us, getting a little snapshot of this great story. One block, two businesses, three families, a Detroit story, and Belt Magazine online. Please look it up. We'll try to link it, right, Laura? We'll send it out on our Facebook page and on Twitter as well. Thank you, Tim. Keep up the good work. We want more stories like this.
All right. Thank you for the invite.
The Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Here's Marie Osborne.
Well, Rochelle, you know, the big story, of course, of the week continues to be the shooting that took place in San Bernardino and the repercussions of the myriad of repercussions, political and social and so on, that from that event. But you and I both discussed this and talked about kids.
Yes. It is my greatest concern that we're not spending enough time dealing with what all of this is doing to children who are becoming so inured to violence that nothing bothers them. You know, I never saw a dead body until I was an adult. So the idea that they're watching, you know, blood and gore and fear and terrorism.
And watching it unfold as it happens on TV, right?
You don't even have a chance to get them prepared for what they're seeing.
No, exactly. Well, we wanted to get some answers about talking about children, the impact of all this on kids. Dr. Donna Rockwell is joining us, a licensed clinical psychologist. Dr. Rockwell, whenever there's an event like this, I always think about, my children are grown, but I always think about how, with parents with small children, how do you possibly start explaining something as terrorizing as this and frightening as this to adults, much less to children?
Well, yes, I think it's actually the question of our time. I agree with you. We have a whole generation of young people coming up in an era of terrorism, of being exposed to violence. And I might also say violence in the form of video games and other such things. And I think that's why you might be seeing a lot of children not reacting in ways we think they might, because they're sort of used to seeing death, whether it's virtual or in reality. So I think there are certain things to consider. And one is that there's actually been violence since the beginning of time. So how do we stand up as adults and grown-ups and parents in our generation in the way that parents have in previous generations, when soldiers went off to World War II, when there were the Nazis proclaiming they wanted to take over the world? We've had really actually a lot of violence and fears of terror for many, many years. So I think this is really about parenting and how we show up as grown-ups, as benefactors and protectors of our children, and how to have emotional intelligence in dealing with violence when it comes up in our contemporary culture.
Okay, can we have a round of applause?
Yes.
Because I could not agree more with what she just said.
Absolutely.
Not anymore.
Absolutely. And Dr. Rockwell, we're dealing with just horrific types of crimes and massive numbers. For instance, you're talking about nearly 38,000 people, you know, hurt or killed in gun accidents, 12,000 killed and 24,000, almost 25,000 injured. That's more than three times the size of the town that I grew up in as a little girl. So when you see those types of numbers and there's this relentless drumbeat of violence every night on the television news, which, of course, I didn't want my daughter to watch. Talk a little bit about how you can structure something like that when it's so pervasive.
Well, thank you so much for saying that you shouldn't have, you know, we should not let our children watch these things on television.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to say that our children can feel every single emotion that we're feeling. Our emotions are not spoken. Our emotions are felt and expressed through our bodies and through our affect. So if we're petrified, if we're scared, if we're standing in front of the television, allowing our grown-up selves to be re-traumatized over and over and over again, from one cable network to another cable network, to nightly news, to the radio, to cut-ins, every breaking news, right? We've all been in journalism.
That's right.
Everything's breaking news. Is there anything that's not breaking news anymore? So we are in a culture of traumatization. We need to turn off the television. We need to understand that there's life beyond the media. We are really hurting our children by allowing them to sit as sitting ducks to all of this trauma. So as parents, we need to turn the television off. We need to take out the Monopoly board or go for a walk or turn on a movie or discuss a book. We need to take the lead, and we need to set a standard for how our lives unfold. Dinner needs to be at the same time as it usually is. Bedtimes need to be the same, waking up the same. They're taking their messaging from us. And the other point is, yes, there's tremendous amount of violence, but there's also tremendous amount of good. And we're seeing people become heroes. We're seeing the actual true beautiful depths in a good way of what the human being is capable of. So we as adults and parents need to remember to keep the story even. There's so much good going on. And if you look at it, there is a lot of gun violence and a lot of incredibly extraordinary lives are being snuffed out of the potential that they could become. But we need to also focus on the positive. We need to reassure our children. There wasn't a shooting in our neighborhood. The police are trying to do what they can, or the government is trying to do what they can. So we need to reassure them that the grown-ups are in charge. 6 years and under really should not be exposed to this at all. It's suggested. And so when you get to like 8 or 9 years old, you can start talking to them. And we can talk about how to ask questions to our children, so that they can express themselves in ways where we're not further traumatizing them.
So, Dr. Rockwell, what I hear you saying is that we parents need to be the children's protectors, basically. We need to be the filter. Society is not going to be filtering what they're exposed to. We have to be filtering that.
Yes, of course. And that goes for time on the internet. That goes on how much time they get to play video games, whether they can play violent video games.
Can I ask you about that?
It's a very wide conversation.
Can I ask you about that very quickly? Because I just recently had a 10-year-old nephew over who was playing a video game. And when I looked over his shoulder, I'm not his parent, of course, I looked over and I thought to myself, wow, you know, I just wouldn't have allowed that. And I didn't say anything to anyone because it's, again, not my child. But I wonder, because parents, when you say no video games, they go, oh, that's impossible. It's impossible. Is it impossible?
Well, everything's about discernment, right? Discerning what video game is appropriate or what video game is not appropriate. And we have to be in charge there. This is sort of a pet peeve of mine, but I really think that parents are allowing children to run the household.
Oh,
sometimes.
My goodness. Let me applaud that. Can you hear that applause?
Yes, yes.
And we really need to take control back, because we're creating adults. And, you know, this is another thing that they say to talk about in the midst of all this violence, is to talk to our children about values and morality and what makes a good person. And, you know, these are evil acts. There are no evil people. These people have problems. They have issues. And it is actually an opportunity to speak to our children about empathy.
Well,
and feeling bad feelings, feeling sorry for the people who are hurt, whose families were hurt. And as long as we're actually present with our children and discussing with them, present with them, really. So some of the suggestions are to ask open-ended questions to our kids, like, what do you want to know about what happened? You know, or tell me what you've heard about what happened.
To make it easier for them to be able to talk about it.
Exactly. And
yes,
then they can express all of their feelings, and then we can correct them. So we don't know what they're secretly fearing.
Well,
in other words, in their minds, they might be thinking, well, I think that the terrorist is going to come to my shopping center or my movie theater, and I'm afraid that they're going to kill you, mommy. And then you can reassure the child. It's all about reassurance. Well, they're not going to come to our movie theater. Mommy's okay.
Yeah.
The grown-ups are in charge.
We do want to get in one last question, because I want to make sure you deal with this. Marie's thought and your use of the word discernment was so important, because you can be present in your children's lives in your home. But, you know, when they go other places and the other kids are playing the video games or their parents let them watch the news, it's very hard. I mean, it's a hard choice, but it's about making that choice. Can you speak a little to that choice?
Well, it's about being mindful, really. It's about being mindful of what lessons we teach our children, and then having trust in them and in our own selves as parents, that when they go out in the world, even if they're exposed to it, they'll be able to come home and talk to us about it. And so really, as parents, we're providing a context of emotional intelligence for our children, because bad stuff is always going to happen. It always has happened. The question is, how can we make our children resilient, intelligent, and wise, even at a young age, so that they can understand there are heroes and there are people who are not well.
We want to thank you so much for being with us to talk about a problem that we've got to solve, and we appreciate your thoughts about how to help children while we're trying to solve it. Thank you so much, Dr. Rockwell.
The Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Here's Rochelle Riley.
So what do you do for a second act in a city that's having its second act and in a mansion that's had maybe, you know, three or four acts? Well, one person who can tell us is the fabulous and wonderful Judy Goss, who owns the Sanders Mansion in Palmer Woods. And yes, that's Sanders Fudge and Confectionery family, folks. So
sweet place.
Yes. Judy, welcome to In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle, conversation you care about. And we're glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we want to start, first of all, thank you for inviting me to your home the time that I was there. You had a lovely, lovely reception with the string quartet and amazing food. What I want to do, since I got to bring Marie for a whole nother visit, is tell our listeners about the house.
Well, it's a Tudor Revival home, and it's historical Palmer Woods. The Saunders was built in 1929 for Fred Saunders, Jr., who's a candy and ice cream company fame. 12,000 square feet, exquisitely hand-carved woodwork and stained glass windows, and each door is actually a piece of art. Brass railings adorn the marble staircase, and now that I am being hosted by Airbnb, actually I am their host, I give out the Sanders candy if you happen to come by.
Oh, my goodness. I was going to ask you if you had bumpy cake.
I haven't tried that myself, but I'll have to write that down.
Yes.
Yes. Well, the reason we're talking to you, so our listeners will know, is that you have turned this gorgeous mansion that has been your home into a bed and breakfast. And talk a little bit about you're familiar with Airbnb, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that that is like just the most amazing
revolutionized
thing.
Hoteling, that's for sure.
Definitely.
Talk about the decision to do this, to make your private space, even if it's, you know, grand and glorious, into a space for guests.
Well, I feel that I am promoting the positive image of Detroit by sharing my space on Airbnb. I think I'm creating a world people can belong to. And this is a process to build trust in our community.
I like that idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Build trust in the community.
Now, Judy, tell us, how many bedrooms do you have? Give us some of the particulars. How many bedrooms do you have? Do you rent them all out at once? I mean, can you do a wedding there? Tell us that.
Well, actually, there are 9 bedrooms, 11 bathrooms. There's, of course, a large professional kitchen, gym, spa, ballroom, English pub, billiard parlor, and a theater.
All the necessities. Wow. All the necessities.
Very required. Amenities required.
So it has everything. I have not rented all of the rooms out, but you can rent the entire house.
Wow.
Oh, that's wow.
Airbnb handles strictly rooms. They may rent 2 rooms at a time. I think the max I have rented through Airbnb are 3 bedrooms, which was a family. Each one has a private bathroom, so they're all suites.
That's amazing.
And tell us about the folks who come there. Are they Detroiters who are just looking for a fabulous night away, or are they out-of-towners? What do they tell you?
Well, actually, I have 7 reviews on Airbnb, and I've had 7 guests. But I've had people come from California that have been shopping for real estate in Detroit. I've had people from Chicago, Toronto, another place, locally, Novi, a date night out.
Yeah.
It's a minimum a 2-night rental. So it's been pretty Right now, I'm looking forward to the auto show because I have someone coming from Australia with five people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's exciting for me. That will probably be the largest group for an event. So people do come, though, for sporting events. I've had families come for the Tigers game. I had a family I host for Thanksgiving for the Lions football game, which was just great for them to come that far and for us to win.
Yay.
Yes. So, and they spent Thanksgiving dinner with us. So it's open. You know, Airbnb, they are in, 190 countries, 34,000 cities, 2 million listings, and 60 million guests.
That is stunning.
So my decision came from their anti-discrimination policy. Their safety is their number one concern. And they have a host guarantee of $1 million for each one of their hosts.
That
guarantee is that they don't destroy your space.
Oh, because I was going to ask. Now, a lot of people will be coming through, and how much work is there for you, and how much work is there after people have gone?
I kind of enjoy this, but it's not a lot of work. It's breakfast, though I did Thanksgiving dinner, but I was doing it for my family anyway. But I definitely do breakfast. And when they leave, of course, you know, there's always the linen. And, you know, who knows? I do everything myself because I am retired. So I do have the time. And so really, it doesn't make me feel that I'm being overworked at all. It just makes me feel that I have shared space. And when I get such great reviews, I really am enjoying this immensely, meeting new people and hosting, you know, something I never thought that would be in my life of hosting something like this. But I am enjoying it immensely.
Judy, tell us what you did very quickly in your previous life.
Well, my first life, besides being an athlete, I was a clinical chemist for Exxon for 20 years. I then changed, went and got an MBA in business, and I came to remarried Larry Doss, who's a mover and shaker here, and I opened up a company called Young Doss Financial Services. And then I was able to actually work doing what I really felt was my calling, was being a personal trainer. So I was able to have the gym here and run clinics here, and that's
great. Wow.
And then I guess the most rewarding thing is to run the Lawrence P. Doss Scholarship Foundation after my husband passed. And I have been doing that for 15 years with 50 scholars, 38 graduates out of Michigan colleges, and spending a lot of time with them. So at this stage in my life, someone mentioned Airbnb. You have such a big space. Maybe you could share this with some people. And I said, you know, that's a great idea.
What a great idea.
That is amazing.
We're glad you did. Judy, thank you so much for joining us here on In the Mix. What a great story. We can't wait to see how well you do at Auto Show.
Oh, that'll be great. Yes, yes.
Awesome.
And please, come by anytime.
We will. Once again, we're glad you could join us here on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle.
Don't forget to tweet about the show at In the Mix WJR. You can find more information at Facebook.com, In the Mix WJR, or send us an email, InTheMixWJR@gmail.com. See you next week.